You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Sorabat, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Caro Adgarian, the author of Rise the Euphrates. It's a first novel recently published by Random House. Now, how do Armenians begin a story?
They begin it with the phrase gar uchi gar, which means there was and there was not.
And can you explain to me, what does that mean?
Well, it's you know, and our version would be once upon a time. Mm-hmm. But I love that sense of gar uchi gar, there was and there was not, because of course that tells you right off the bat that every story contains light and also shadow. There's what is and there's what is taken away or what isn't. And I think that's a great way to set up a story. I love that in all the Armenian folk tales. That's how they begin.
It's an interesting novel, this novel, which begins with a memory of the 1915 genocide of the Armenians as performed by the Ottoman Turks, because the book begins with the answer to the heroine Sidalun's quest. She is looking through her life for the story of her grandmother, and that begins the novel rather than ends it. And I was wondering how the book came to be structured in that way.
I you're talking about the chapter one, that's the genocide mm-hmm. chapter. I felt it was so important. The book really is set as quest for identity. And in doing so, her quest for, you know, to heal this family. And the 1915 genocide so defines her grandmother's life and her grandmother's character, which in turn defines everyone else in this family, that I felt that if I delayed revealing what happened during the genocide, delayed it until the moment when Seta actually realizes what's happened to her grandmother, then the reader wouldn't understand Kasard, the mm-hmm. grandmother. And I think it's essential that the reader really have sympathy for this woman who's a tough broad, and you know what made her a tough broad. And I also I think it's good for the reader to be a step ahead of Seta.
Well, it's interesting because it made me think of there was and there was not. Mm-hmm. The quest in the book is, in a sense, for the grandmother's missing name, a right. name that she has forgotten, and the reader has encountered it in the first chapter.
Right.
And so there's a very strange cyclical feeling as mm-hmm. a result, the search for something that the reader has encountered as something long ago past.
Right, so then the quest is not so much for the literal name, but for the understanding of the name, and for the tale to complete, to come to fruition, as it were, so that you, at the end, have that aha. Of course, that's the name.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because, beginning after its prologue with this chapter mm-hmm. of genocide, the book at first struck me that it was going to be something like The Painted Bird. You mm-hmm. know, the horror is so intense. And, mm. and of course, it's not a novel of horrors. It's a novel of maturation. Mm-hmm. Were you nervous about an opening so wildly discordant with the emotional tone of the rest of the book?
Well, I'm not sure it is so emotionally discordant. I think there is certainly the first chapter dealing with the genocide. You have the inherent drama in atrocity on such a grand scale, and this 9-year-old girl witnessing these horrors and then going through a death march. But I think equally as horrific is to watch how such an event can wound a person on such a deep level that wound never heals, and it manifests in all kinds of ways. She can come to America. She can live, you know, a comfortable American immigrant life. She can have a daughter. The daughter has a daughter. You know, we're in modern day America, yet this wound festers. And I think on a certain level that is more dramatic, that to watch this very American family come apart because they cannot deal with this thing in the past. But I see what you mean just on the sense of action. I mean, certainly the
well, and also it's a very spare prose. I mean, throughout, mm-hmm. it's sort of the language of folktale, but the language of folktale as applied to a massacre mm-hmm. yields a very frightening effect. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of jewelly and distanced tone about nearly nonstop bloodletting.
Well, I think I felt it was essential that the book not be sentimental in any way. And that if you were going to walk through a genocide, and if you were going to walk through this three generations of this family, and try to gain a degree of understanding, and that, after all, is what Seta's quest is to gain some kind of understanding of this legacy. The prose ought to be spare. The voice ought to reflect Seta's voice and the influences that have been imposed on her, the church, the Armenian language, the street, the kids at school. All those elements must be in the voice, but it ought not to be sentimental.
Melancholia seems to be the moody melancholia, uh-huh. The predominant strain. Now, as a Russian myself, I would frequently be told by friends that I was as moody as I was because the Russians did not go through an Enlightenment. We went straight from the Dark Ages to Romanticism.
so that's it.
This was explaining uh-huh. my uneven temperament. But there is, in at least two of the characters, the mother in this book and Teresa, a very brooding and clotted quality of feeling. Was that an easy kind of character to make? I mean, is that Armenian really, or is it literary?
Let's see how to take that question apart. Of course, Teresa and Araxi are very different characters, but in a way they're similar characters. These are women who are really defined by the community, by their looks. Araxi is this beautiful woman who came of age in, let's say, the early 50s. And she is, rather than be defined by who she is inside, she is defined by this sexy body. Teresa is the girl in elementary school who smells. And I'm discovering as I travel around that everybody had someone in their elementary school that seemed to smell. But as she ages, she is large chested. She's very attractive to men, and I think the melancholy is in both their cases inherent in their characters. But it's also a product of being different than how they're perceived and not being able to break out of that in some way. And both their characters go through a lot to try to break out of that role they've been cast into.
What I wondered, at the risk of confusing issues even more, though, is, do you have a sense, having written an Armenian family saga, mm-hmm. is there an Armenian national character?
I think you're onto something when you talk about melancholy. There's a phrase that I've heard many times, and actually one of the women in the book actually speaks the phrase, that the difference between the Armenians and the Jews is that the Jews are angry and the Armenians are sad.
And the Jews are sad,
too. The Jews are sad, too, and the Armenians are angry. But I think there is something about there's something about the fact that this genocide, the first genocide of the century, over three-quarters of a race was wiped out. And the world has never sort of put an end to this by saying, yes, this happened. The Turks have never, had to stand up and to paraphrase the characters in the novel, for the Armenians there was no Nuremberg. And so what's happened is that's forced a lot of the pain of the genocide underground in the Armenian psyche. And I think it's, you know, I think often sadness is veiled rage.
Mm-hmm. I was very amused, of course, by the introduction of Teresa. It's the funniest chapter in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yes, I think it is true. It's not just that everyone had someone in their class who smelled or was odd. It's that one spent so much of one's childhood fearing that one was
that's
oneself.
That's absolutely right.
That character.
That's right. And that's something I really wanted to look at in the book. That whole, in Armenian, there's that word, odar, which means outsider. And, of course, no matter who you are, where you come from, you fear that one day you're going to be cast as the odar. And you never seem to grow out of that. At every stage of life, there is there are those that are on the inside track and those that are on the outside. And that was fun to play with in the book.
Was this your first novel?
Yes.
First written as well?
Uh-huh.
How did it shape itself? What was its progress?
Well, the book began with a dream. I was 20 and I was living in Paris, and I had come down with an awful case of bronchitis and had a very high fever, and I had this dream, this operatic dream one night, in which this old woman came to me. And when I awoke, I didn't so much remember what she said, but her voice. I could not get away from this voice. I mean, for days I was listening to this woman, and I thought, I've got to write down this voice. I've got to do something with the voice. So I began to work on a short story, and then the book grew from there. It became a novella. Then it became a novel. It kept expanding, and I knew from the beginning the point I would have to get to. I knew where Seta had to go. But I had no idea how I was going to get there. And it was really a process of discovery and unfolding for me.
I'm talking to Carol Edgarian, the author of Rise of the Euphrates, recently published by Random House. Now, there are an equal number of young writers who look forward to dealing with family materials as who say, the one thing I knew I never wanted to do as a writer was to open that chest.
Right.
And some people spend their careers fighting against it.
Right.
Were you inclined to it from the start?
Well, this is not my family.
Ah.
This book is not autobiographical. I can't tell you what my parents hadn't read the book until this winter when I had it in galleys, and I said, okay, you can read this. And there was that silence of a week as they read. And then they called me, and what I heard in their voices was this incredible relief that it wasn't about them. You know, I think they had thought I had pulled out every skeleton in the familial closet. But the book's not about my family. So, and I guess I'm in the camp that I feel much more liberated when I can work with invented characters and really see where they're going to go my own life is, I wouldn't want to put my life on the page.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I was talking about here was not the literal autobiographical incident, but one's personal culture, mm-hmm. you know, the mm-hmm. culture of one's family. And I assume that this is culturally true to your experience.
Well, I'm half Armenian.
Mm-hmm.
But this book, I grew up in a pretty American household. When I was very young, I was more involved with the Armenian culture, like from the age of up until about 5 or 6. So this book was a process of discovery for me, too. What was interesting for me was how readily the voices, the Armenian voice, came up through me.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost as if it came up from my bones. And that was very interesting.
There is a repeated chorus through the book. Fathers in particular say, don't be a victim. You mm-hmm. mustn't be a victim.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a necessary conquering of self-hatred and cultural confusion in the writing of this kind of novel?
I don't know about in this kind of a novel. In this novel, that is very much a theme. Of course, when the father who says that is the man who's about to be killed by the Turks, and he is resolute, or it remains a mystery whether he actually does get killed or how he gets killed. But he is resolute that the family is not going to lose its dignity. And I think more than becoming a victim, this is a book that this is a family that is determined to maintain its dignity.
Well, it seemed to me to be a book about breaking silence.
Right.
And that all of the characters have to break their silence in some way. And if one is justified in looking at anything in a book as a parable for the book, there's a tune played on the dudek. Is that how it's?
Duduk. Yeah.
Duduk. And it said that the person playing the melody is doing the less difficult job. The person who's holding the sustained note, which seems to be the note of melancholy or mm-hmm. the wail, mm-hmm. Is really doing the work. And I thought of that as a metaphor for the book itself, of
yeah.
finding the one note.
That's right. That's right, and that the person who plays the melody gets the applause, but to hold that note, that's the hardest. Yeah.
How did you discover that? I mean, was that? It seems such a beautiful metaphor for what's going on, but I've never heard the sound of that flute.
Oh, it's a beautiful. It's always usually played in pairs, and it is. When you hear it, there is no mistaking the duduk. It is the sound of melancholy. It really is. I can't describe it any other way. I got married last summer, and I thought about having a duduk play at the wedding, and then it occurred to me. Would it be possible to have a happy duduk song? And I don't think it's possible. The keening duduk, I think it would not bode well. So I decided against that.
It remained on the pages of the novel.
It remains on the pages of the novel. That's right.
Now, there is a feeling, though, in the last chapters of a life outside the novel, entering the novel. This woman, Seta, is a freelance writer. She brings an outsider home to her parents. There's a marriage and the birth of a...
No marriage.
No marriage. There's a birth of a child.
Seta's the one to break the taboos, and she's going to break them by not getting... being unmarried and pregnant.
Well, what I'm talking about here is that the book begins in history,
mm-hmm.
and then it's as if... it takes in Armenian stories and folk tales, mm-hmm. becomes the story of a family, and at the end, it's almost as if it breaks open into an outside world.
Well, that's Seta's mission. She is about in the prologue, she's pregnant, and so this is an urgent task at hand. She wants to find what is going to be the legacy, what is going to be her story that she's going to pass on, because she has been so affected and defined by this event that happened three generations earlier, and she has watched her grandmother and her mother really be crushed by this event and make so many of their decisions through the veil of that event. So that's an aspect. But, the first line of the book, these are the things that were not lost. This is a book that's really an accounting of what occurred in this family, Seta's family, to bring her to the point where she is about to give birth and hopefully deliver some hope to this unborn child. So I think it does. Absolutely, it's opening out. And I see her as just beginning at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm. Will there be more about her?
It's funny. I thought I was done with Seta Loon, but I'm working on a new book that has nothing to do with Seta Loon. But it's my mind has just begun to turn to thinking about, gee, it's going to be interesting to see where she ends up in 5, 10, 15 years. So maybe at some point.
Now, did sections of this book, were sections of this in literary magazines before its publication?
No, I held it very close until uh-huh. it was done.
Because there is very much the sense, and I'm not, you know, being vatic here. Carol Edgarian and I were at one point at a writing conference in Squaw Valley, but there feel like there are many godparents to book. I think about Amy Tan and Robert Stone, and uh-huh. you know, the comments from them. It seems as if it was, you know, blessed by a literary community. How was it discovered?
Well, let's see. In terms of the actual book, I worked on the book for 10 years. And then, in 86, I had been introduced to an agent, and she, Amanda Urban, and she read the first 50 pages of the book and liked what she saw and asked me when I was going to be done. And I said, oh, 6 months tops. And she said, great, call me when you're done. And 6 months turned into 6 years. And I never called her. I was working on the book, and I was obsessive about the book. And I didn't want any other voices entering into the work. But at the end, in 92, I put the thing in a box and sent it off to her with a note saying, I hope you remember me. And she did, and she read the book very quickly and was excited. And then things happened very, next to the pace of the tortoise, which was my pace. She sent the book out on the day Bill Clinton was elected and said, you know, now she sent it to a handful of editors, and she said, you know, it's going to take a couple weeks for everybody to read it. It's a long book. 2 days later, Random House bought the book. So it happened very quickly. It's great.
I'm speaking to Carol Edgarian, the author of Rise of the Euphrates, recently published by Random House. There's a sort of double narrative voice in this. Although I know it's a first-person novel by and large, it's interesting that on the one hand it's the voice of an adolescent young woman, but on the other hand it has a chronicle or folktale mm-hmm. voice mm-hmm. as well. And part of it is quite incantatory mm-hmm. and poetic. And it was interesting to see those two voices being braided, because normally one thinks of the child's voice as being quite apart from mm-hmm. the kind of, what would you say, crone voice
right,
of folk
right.
tale. And I wondered how that evolved.
Well, I think there could be a reading of the book that this is a book about one character becoming a woman. And even when Seta is a child, I wanted, of course, she's telling, the tale is being told by Seta Loon, pregnant, an adult. But even in the moments of childhood, I wanted her to be able to have access to that woman she would become, so that at the end of the book, it would be emerging of two rather diverse voices.
But it seemed also to be an accessing of her grandmother's
that's right,
voice
that's
as
right.
well.
Set as the vessel for the story, and the women and even the men and the legends and the history come up through her. Absolutely.
I guess that's why I found it to be, there are several references in it to cups and mm-hmm. bowls and mm-hmm. I kept finding
bellies.
I kept finding, you know, that the narrative seemed to be rising out of a process of multiple tellings. Mm-hmm. Seta is telling us the story of how her grandmother told her the story.
That's right.
And so there's a consequent, I thought, emotional complexity of voice in it.
Thank you. Yeah.
But do you have a grandmother who has spoken to you? Because I certainly do, and I'm just curious whether the voices of the ancestors play a part in your life.
They do. I dedicated the book to my grandmother, who's been dead a long time. My grandmother was a very different person than this grandmother in the book. But I have always felt as though my grandmother sits on my shoulder. And I know in my life there are things that I know or have come to know that there's no rational way that that there is some sort of, you know, collective unconscious or whatever that is. That wonderful knowing, that deeper knowing, is something I definitely wanted to braid into this work, because that's what's underneath all of it.
Well, the grandmother has a revulsion against the store-bought American item. And what's nice about the book is that it does not feel, its prose does not feel store-bought. It feels personal and handmade.
Thank you.
Like the cooking in the book.
Like the cooking, that's right. Have you seen those women? I don't know if your grandmother was like that, but it's something so wonderful to me where they measure everything in the cup of their hands. Have you seen that?
Well, my grandmother always had a small piece of bread that she kneaded between her fingers, always.
Oh, really?
Always. She just carried it. It was like what a rosary bead might be for someone of another religion.
Isn't that fantastic? The bit of dough. And what, at the end of the day, what happened to
it? She would stick it under the banister where my mother would disgustedly find it.
like wads of gum.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like this was like a
schoolgirl.
You
wouldn't want her seated at your dining room table.
Yeah, you might find her. So yes, I guess I did know that woman and her efforts with kneading and mm-hmm. baking mm-hmm. in your book. Was that a part of the family background?
My grandmother was a great cook. But, you know, I think this is something that's certainly true to Armenians. Food is the essential nurturing. And so, and the family life revolves around the table. This is true for so many ethnic groups. But I was raised in a household which my father, though very American, never really recognized how much of an Armenian man he really was. And one of the things that was so characteristic is that when he, you know, at breakfast, two lines into breakfast, he was talking about what are we going to have for dinner, you know, and the entire day was shaped around the food. So that definitely is part of the Armenian culture.
I've been talking to Carol Edgarian, the author of Rise of the Euphrates, recently published by Random House. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse, mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.